Welcome to the French Connections Tuesday edition. It is today's date is the 26th day of July 2011. Of course, my name is Darryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here for another important broadcast. Got lots of stuff to share with you today from an old dear friend of mine, someone who's been on this program dozens of times, and we've talked about issues that range from soup to nuts in the conspiracy that we have followed so closely over the years. And in fact, David Pidcock, a good friend of mine, has taken some time off to take care of himself and make sure that he's up and strong and everything, and that's working out for him, and I'm so happy to hear that. So, you know, we're back in the swing of things here, and I'm going to bring David up right away because we have a whole host of subjects we want to cover today. David, are you with me?
I think so, Darren, yes.
Well, great. David, you know, we were all a little worried about you, and the fact that you're back stronger and strong as ever is a wonderful thing for everybody to know about. So you want to give us a two-second pitch on how you're feeling and what's new with you?
Yes, thank you, Darren. I had what they call a mild stroke.
Yeah.
Driving, fortunately, I was able to pull into a friend's house and... I asked him to call the ambulance, so I was in the best stroke hospital in the country in Sheffield. So that was in March, and I was out at Easter and making steady progress, you know, almost the voice is back, and I'm standing and moving around. I've been to London twice, and so basically I'm on the mend, as they say.
Well, you know what the best thing that I noticed right away is that within weeks, no, it was about 4 or 5 weeks after that event, you were back scanning the news, so you didn't miss a beat, and we've been in contact with one another through emails and conversations. So let's get right back. Let's get into this, David. First, I want to touch on the significance of the mistakes they have made in Norway. This is important to talk about because it's going to segue into our man Murdoch and how he's spinning this in his organization in the United States. But they've made some mistakes here, and it was instantly recognized as a Mossad / CNM network kind of hit, because this guy, you know, the internet is a wonderful thing. This guy was outed instantly, David. He had contacts with the guys in Israel. He had contacts with pro-Israeli sites, so forth and so on. What's your take on all that, David?
Well, I mean, to add, basically, there's nothing to add except the good fortune that we have of the internet and people being able to network and actually sort of pinpoint the links. And it's very clear, I think, from all the aspects, particularly from Gilad Altsman, who has been extremely good in identifying these links with Israel, and I'll come to that in a minute. But basically, it has all the hallmarks of Mossad, and as we've been seeing all the way, you know, to the past 100 years, and certainly since the founding of Israel, we can see that this is exactly their hallmark. And as somebody was saying, and Altsman, and this the fact that, but nothing's been mentioned on any of them. I've watched everything from RT, BBC, CNN, etc., but nobody mentioned the actual event that was taking place on the island, which was the boycott of Israel.
Right.
And this is quite amazing that nobody, and I've monitored, I've taped things, but nothing's actually come up.
Yeah.
So we can see precisely, and when you then see what's actually in the Hebrew press, and which Altman has pointed out, and I've downloaded that and I've had it verified, basically they're saying that the Oslo criminals have paid. It's stupid and evil not to desire the death of those who call for a boycott of Israel.
Yes.
And this is the sort of tone. And the other one thing, he said, we Jews are not Christians. In the Jewish religion, there is no obligation to love or mourn for the enemy. So the key issue is that this is definitely Mossad, and it is for the reason that Norway has been very staunch and basically come out in support of Palestine or the Palestinians or justice. I mean, if it was the boot was on the other foot, we'd be supporting the Israelis if they were under the same conditions that the Palestinians are. So definitely it's Israel.
Well, we've got a guy in charge of that country, the prime minister, who is a member of Bilderberg. And and he, of course, may have loyalties outside of Norway. However, the will of his people is so clear and so strong that he won't even menace that relationship that he's got with them at the moment. But certainly, there was looks like there was some inside help, at least a tertiary help, if not direct. When I looked at this guy having a policeman's uniform and yeah. And having they knew his name when they arrived on the scene and all this other stuff, and it was it sounds very very convoluted. But here's the real rub. Yesterday, my wife early in the morning went on a French news website, a national news website, and they mentioned that this guy had ties to the British National Party as well as the Mossad. It said in the headline.
Yeah, EDL, the English Defense League.
Yes,
definitely.
And now here's the interesting thing. I went down an hour and a half later to find the same story, and it had vanished.
Gone. Yeah.
Now, we know that there's people they've got scrubbers and cleaners of the news out there trying to keep people away from any of the connections.
Yes.
But this is important because people in the world at large, and especially the Norwegians themselves,
yes.
see the connections, David.
Oh, well, I mean, they've hit the children of the existing political party. They're not going to let this go. And somebody's had a nice email. The headline was basically, this is sort of Norway's 9/11. This is precisely what they've done. And we'll come on to that sort of thing later on. But what is intriguing is the fact that in Sheffield, in South Yorkshire, one of the largest police forces in the UK, the senior intelligence analyst for 12 years has been working for them, Tony Farrell.
Yep.
Has basically in his report for last year said that basically the terrorism is government led. It's not the Muslims. It's basically these are all inside job. Now, of course, the police were beside themselves, and they fired him on the spot, and his case is coming up. But he had written this, that it was not the Muslims, that this is all engineered by government and government agencies. I had him on my show. I went back to the radio in Sheffield that I do mm-hmm. occasionally, and we had a three-hour session, and we've now put it out into the public domain. And but he's saying precisely that it is government, not Islam, which constitutes the real terror threat.
That's right. Well, and here's the thing, David. You know, we got this guy, Alan Sobrowski, who came out recently on television, on Press TV.
Yeah.
And I was the first person to interview Alan Sobrowski after he went public. And so that's some months ago. In fact, about a year ago or so. Now, this guy was head of international studies at West Point, a visiting fellow professor at Georgetown,
yes.
a doctorate's degree, a military man, a
not
U.S. Marine.
Lefty.
Yeah, no, not a lefty. U.S. Marine Corps, the whole bit, and also Jewish. And came out and gave these people the full story on 9/11, and I'll tell you, he didn't leave anything out. And
well,
I was absolutely gobsmacked. Now this is, of course, let's talk a little bit about Britain's present relationship with Press TV.
Yes.
They're trying to get them off the satellite so that people can't watch them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I've done quite a few programs with Press TV. And know them very well, and also IRIB, the Iranian National Broadcaster, which I'm just doing a program for them. So, but Iran, of course, the IRIB, and of course Al Jazeera used to be good. It's not as good as it was, but Press TV do have freedom. But IRIB also, but it's unfortunately broadcast in Farsi. But these are we have to get stuff out on these things. And utilize them while ever they're still in business. But they were almost taken off the air some years ago, you know, because people, as you know, the truth is the greatest enemy to these kind of people, and they don't want it out there.
Well, do you think possibly, David, and I think there's probably some truth to this, they rolled this hit out against these Norwegians to take the front page away from the Murdoch scandal?
Yes, right. I think that's part of it. You know, never, as it was said, Rahm Emanuel said, never miss an opportunity to take advantage of a situation.
That's right.
But I think that's right. But I think that's rumbling on, and this is actually, I think it's done everybody a favour in many respects, that people are actually saying, well, if he's supposed to be in favour of, you know, white Anglo-Saxon or whatever it is, Norwegian Protestantism, why is he killing them? You know, this is... but it's shocked everybody in the best possible way that they're actually... literally thinking. This made people think, and that's, I think, the first
thing. Well, he claims to be a full Freemason, so let's talk for a moment about...
Right.
We've had long, long program discussions about the origins of the Orient Lodge and Carasso and their movement. Now, we know that Freemasonry, by and large, has been infiltrated by money interests from this Zionist community. And even before they called themselves Zionists, they were well ensconced with their large sums of capital into this group, and now today they virtually control the flow of that of those organizations at the top. Am I correct in saying that?
Well, I think you're absolutely. But it's much longer and older than the latter day manifestations. We can trace. There's a very good book, Terrorism and the Illuminati, by David Livingstone. I don't know if you've got it, but I'll email you the PDF. And he's got the full history, very detailed. But I did my own book, my own research, you know, back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and Satanic Voices, Ancient and Modern, which was... You've got it on your website.
Yes, I do.
The point is that the oldest reference, or the claim is with Freemasonry, is that it is the agenda is for the people like these clowns, the EDL and everybody, and the Knights Templars, is for the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem.
Yep.
But Alex Horn, who is a 33rd degree member of the Masons, wrote a very good book, Solomon's Temple, and you know, and in its relationship to Freemasonry. And he said our first glorious Grand Master was not Solomon, but it was Nimrod, and the glorious center for Masonry was not the Temple of Solomon, but it was the Tower of Babel. Now, this is the deception. People, my uncles who were members of the military, they had no idea that what they were actually doing was planning to rebuild the Tower of Babel, not Solomon's Temple. So it's mad, but the deception is actually masterful. People have no idea, and they are duped into believing that they're doing something very good. But for instance, when you wonder why these things go wrong, why the police. Now, the thing that I did hear from Sweden, one of your listeners, Thomas, in Sweden, said that he was listening to the radio, and he said, I was just astonished that the reason the police were saying, the reason that they were late arriving is that they had to go and change their uniforms. Now, if there was any more crass than saying, yeah, the house is on fire, but I've got to go and change my... so he was laughing, but in a way, he was just saying, but it's clear there was, why didn't they get there in time? Because it was the agenda was set now. Unmasking the Masonic thing is that now this is what the police and people involved, people involved in the judiciary, bind themselves with the following oaths. I furthermore promise and swear that I will assist a companion Royal Archmason in preference to any other person of equal qualification. I furthermore promise and swear that I will assist the companion Royal Archmason when I see him engaged in any difficulty, and will espouse his cause, whether he be right or wrong. Now, if you, as a policeman or a judge, if you've said that and you get a companion Royal Archmason and he's committed murder, basically you've got to let him off. And that's what the tragedy is. It's it is the undermining. Now, Marcus Tullus. I think we've heard of him. A nation can survive its fools and even the ambitious, but it cannot survive treason from within.
That's right.
And that's what he was saying. Now, to come to this issue that they're saying about the terrorism. Now, this is what Yitzhak Shamir said in an article in 1943 in the Lehi magazine. He said, neither Jewish morality nor Jewish tradition can be used to disallow terror as a means of war. We are very far from any moral hesitation when concerned with the national struggle. First and foremost, terror is for us part of a political war appropriate for the circumstances of today. And he then became, he was the head of the Stern Gang, the terror group.
That's
the guy. Now,
the Stern Gang was an offshoot of the Jabotinskys, wasn't it?
Yeah, the whole thing, the Leahy article, but most of the prime ministers, you know, Yitzhak Shamir and the other clowns, most of them have been terrorists or have been wanted for terror. So to say that what happened, they fully endorse what happened on the island there, and they believe that those Norwegian children and that political party, they're actually valid targets. And so that's what you have to understand. Terrorism is the mark of Zionism and the unorthodox Jews throughout history. There's no doubt about it.
It's interesting, David, because, you know, in the Christian world, when we talk about ends justifying the means, we discuss that in terms of suspending our moral code in order to get something worthwhile in the long and for the larger picture. But the Jews themselves have no problem with the moral code, so really that doesn't apply to them. In other words, it's not a suspending what do they call it, a teleological suspension of ethical principles. They have no ethical principles when it comes to murder in their own behalf.
No, it's actually what the Arabs would say, or the Islamic would be fatherland. It is compulsory. As Napoleon reported in one of the rabbis who he was interviewing about, you know, what was happening, he said, remember, if I didn't cheat, it's because I couldn't. The whole thing is you have to do what you can, and you have to dispossess the goyim as and wherever possible, because they believe that this is what pleases God, even when they don't realize that Jehovah is not God, but is actually Satan. And that's what they have to wake up to, the fact that whatever they're serving is not divine, but diabolical.
Well, my brother, some years ago, owned a business in where I grew up, and he repeatedly had business dealings with the Jewish community, and in each instance, they would end up costing him more than he sold them. And in some instances, they would cost him everything. He finally said, I can't do business with them anymore because they are bent on cheating me in every instance that I do business with them, so I'm not doing it with them anymore.
That's right. Well, he was right, wise, but there are some that I know, you have the Torahcon, those who know the Ten Commandments, and those who actually reject them. The Zionists reject them because it's a secular movement, but they claim the Holy Land is theirs on unholy principles or no principles at all.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, but you know, even though I'm going to go off the reservation on you, David, a little bit. You know, but I had an interview, I did several interviews with David Weiss from Natura Carta.
Yes.
And I asked him point blank, is he a follower of the Talmud? And he said, well, yes. But and I said, well, doesn't that predispose you to the sicknesses of Zionism? And because the Talmud is quite clear on what it allows and what it doesn't allow, and if you're a follower of that, aren't you a part of the problem and not the solution? And he got so angry with me.
Yes.
And he would not. He actually quit the conversation. He quit the interview.
He?
Yes, he did. Yeah, and he won't talk to me anymore.
Oh,
but
dear.
Now, because in the Talmud, they are allowed, and during the Kol Nidra prayer, they're allowed to lie to the Goyim. They can tell us whatever we want to hear. Now, there's a good example of that, David, with Sabbatai Zvi, or Sabbatai
Zvi. Yes, Sabbatai Zvi, yes.
And he, of course, was put on the spot to make his alliances known, and he would not die for his own cause, but rather lied to the caliphate and said, sure, I'll be a Muslim, whatever you want. And that was really the beginning of this Zionist approval of lying to everybody, because you got a guy like John Kerry in America who ran for president.
Yes.
He's not an Irishman. He's from the family Khan. Same people that Dominique Strauss-Kahn. Same family.
Yes.
And but his name, of course, they changed their name to Kerry, just like, you know, Tony Curtis was somebody else, and and you know, what's his name? Kurt Douglas is actually, you got a Scottish name, but his name was Sid Bronstein or something. We have this example after example across the spectrum, and so deception is part of the deal, not just the Mossad's moniker, but rather the whole structure of their system is deception.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you couldn't have put it better. You're right, and this is what people don't realize, and the books that we read, and Israel Shahak and people of that caliber who really have blown the whistle are, you know, they are, you know, giants in terms of their courage to actually blow the whistle. And So we have to be, aware that this is the game plan, and we have to actually wake up to the fact that you're going to have this problem until they're actually outed completely and people see them for what they are.
Well, let's talk about another big win we've had that is under threat of slipping away, and that is the exposure of Mr. Mordecai.
Yes.
And his family and his family of companies and the moral disgust that everyone feels when they even see some of, and they don't know half the story. There's been, you know, they're not even connecting the dots on several murders, on the fact that the little girls, after their death, cell phones were checked, and I think they checked those cell phone messages to make sure they weren't on the hook for any of the stuff
right.
they did.
Yes, I think that's a very good point.
Well, you know, what is your take on this on Mr. Murdoch Mordecai being outed so openly in the British press? But in front of that panel, they succeeded in somehow making him sympathetic in some way. I couldn't believe it, but they did. And I mean, I'm not predisposed in any way to feel any sympathy for this guy, but I watched it kind of without trying to be prejudiced about what I was seeing, and it was very clear they skillfully made him look like some dodgering old knucklehead didn't have a clue when the opposite is true of this stuff.
Oh, of course, yes.
Yeah.
This is about masterful deception, and the power of the press is still, because people know even when it's happened, they're fawning at the foot of Mammon, but it's something that has been very very long standing and old in the United Kingdom, and I want to quote you something from Richard Brinsley Sheridan, who was a British dramatist and a politician, and he was actually the Whig orator and treasury of the Navy between 1806 and 1807. Now, this is what he said about the power of the press, or the liberty. He said, "Give me the liberty of the press, and I will give the minister a venal House of Peers. I will give him a corrupt, servile House of Commons. I will give him the full swing of patronage of officers. I will give him the whole host of ministerial influences. I will give him all the power that place can confer upon him to purchase submission and overawe resistance." Now, if that's exactly what happened in the chamber in the House, they were overawed. Now, but he goes on to say that, "Yes, armed with the liberty of the press, I will go forth undismayed. I will attack the very fabric of that mighty engine. I will shake down corruption from its height and bury it beneath the ruins of the abuses it was meant to shelter." Now, Sheridan was he wrote the Rivals and the School for Scandal, but that is the power of the press, and that was round about 1816 or 1815 when he wrote that. So nothing's changed, and the power of the press still overawes everybody, because they know that this is the way to get to people. You know, your program is important because people get to hear things they would never hear in a million years. And just to continue on this line, if I may, one night in 1880, John Swindon, who was the preeminent New York journalist,
yep.
He was managing editor of the New York Times during the Civil War, was a guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft on his retirement. And someone who even didn't know Swinton offered a toast to an independent press. And this is what Swinton said. He was a Scot, by the way, and there is no such thing as at this date in the world's history in America as an independent press. You know it and I know it. There's not one of you who would dare to write his honest opinions, and you know beforehand it would never appear in print. I'm paid $250 a week, remember this is in the mid-1800s, to keep my honest opinions out of the papers I'm connected with. Others of you have paid similar salaries for similar work. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, and to fawn at the foot of Mammon and sell his country, his race, and his family for his daily bread. You know it and I know it, and what folly it is toasting an independent press. We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes, just like Murdoch. We are their jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Now, or prostitutes, as somebody said, I think it was maybe Muhammad Rafiq.
Yeah.
But that is, now that's the game plan, or that is the game that you're faced with. The power of the press, once you have the power of the pulpit, and you have, or the ability to speak in public and actually command the authority, then of course that's why they go for it, to control all those newspapers, and that's how they manage to subdue everybody, and anybody who speaks out is damaged considerably. But if I could just continue even earlier than that, 1400 years beforehand, the Quran says exactly the same thing about those who write with the pen. And it said, known by the pen and the record which men write, you, Muhammad, are not, by the grace of your Lord, mad or possessed, by no means. Verily for you is a reward and failing, and furthermore you stand on an exalted standard of character. Soon will you see, and soon will they see, which of you is afflicted with madness. Verily it is your Lord who knows best which amongst men are straight from his path. Now he goes on to say, and he knows best those who receive true guide. Therefore, obey not the rejecters who would have you compromise, in order that they in turn may compromise. Neither obey each feeble oathmonger, detractor, spreader abroad of slanders and calumnies, who habitually hinder all that is good, transgressing beyond bounds, the malefactors deep in sin, who are violent and cruel, greedy and base-born, therewithal intrusive. Now, that sums up the press through the last, 1,400 years. But how about that for being spot on the money 1,400 years before Swinton or Brinsley-Sheridan?
Well, you know, David, here's the thing. The press always represents power. And whether or not the power is some sort of cause that it has in its interest, or the power of the money, or whatever the power base is, but it's always about power and presenting the case for power to have control. Yeah. And it's not about power, it's about giving power the right to control.
Yes.
And
sorry. And but that Lord Acton was, I think he summed it up, when he said power tends to corrupt. An absolute power corrupts absolutely, and this is why the power of money is to. I think that the Medici's, they had that view that money to protect power and power to protect money. That's the game, isn't it? And it's all down to believing that they're going to live forever. But the issue of, I mean, eventually, like you've seen Citizen Kane, and
of course,
the stories of particularly Randolph Hearst. The power, he said, you give me the pictures, I'll give you the war. And it is that power, and hence, if you can alter books or you can alter scripture to actually serve your agenda, that's the power of the written.
Well, isn't that what Schofield did with his meta-texting of the Bible?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
But indeed, you're absolutely right. Yeah. So I'm just finishing off a reply to a group, particularly relating to the falsification of scripture. But if you read Deuteronomy, Moses said, tells them, warns them that you will, whatever you've been doing in my lifetime, you will be even worse when I'm gone. And so a copy of the Torah was actually placed in the Ark of the Covenant as to prove that when they alter it, they will be held to account, because that's what's been going on for 3,000 years, falsification.
Well, David, when I came out with much of my information, I was the first person in the alternative press to present the idea that Rothschild and co., all the way back to the Boer War and beyond, and all the way back to the French Revolution and beyond, the connections to this group and this money were where the power lies and the crimes are being generated. And when I said these things, I was savaged. I was savaged by everyone. And interesting that I made some mistakes in partnerships that I didn't realize at the time. My partner Eric Hufschmidt was the brother of James Murdoch's. His stepsister was married to James Murdoch.
Oh, right.
So, but he was my partner, and when I found out he had been playing me as a fool, which I had no idea, I flipped out. And of course, I went ballistic on this guy over the phone. If I could have reached through the phone, I'd have choked him to death. But anyway, that's for another day. And here's the thing. many of the damaging statements made about me, most of them were either exaggerations or fully untrue, completely, but yet the internet never forgets. And the things that were said about me 5, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, still float around. And so the damage to my reputation, when I was invited by somebody very prominent to get involved on an interview on not only on Russia Today, but on Press TV, well, when they went to the internet, of course, there was enough negative stuff about me. If you go to Google and put my name in, Daryl Bradford Smith, the first 25 stories up there are hit pieces against me.
Well, there's the famous saying, isn't it, that be chaste as ice and pure as snow, you will not escape calumny. So you're in good company.
Well, yes, but at the same time, it takes away a little bit of my effectiveness. And sadly, you know, there was a time when I was working with Boleyn, Christopher Boleyn. Now, I don't know what Christopher's story is completely, but I do know some of the things that he has written are very accurate and very powerful. So regardless of what I have as a personal opinion, I have to say, upon reading some of his analysis, I have to agree.
Yes.
So we were working together, and the combination of he and I putting this stuff out, we were juggernauts at the time.
Yes.
And they unseated us through infighting and deception and lies, and so again, some of the momentum was taken out. Now, this is exactly what they don't want to happen with this Norwegian thing. They don't want any momentum to be built around Mr. Mordecai's transgressions and his crimes, because if this alternative press gets enough steam on Murdoch, he will be taken down in the United States as well, and that would be an irreplaceable destruction to the Jews. They would not be able to replace him. He is too big a force within the press. And if his mouthpiece is silenced, they have lost probably 30 to 40% of what they put out in the crap during any news cycle. So they are desperate to save Murdoch because of how important he is to their lives.
Yes, you're right, and the kids, they wouldn't have gone, you know, for these organs of such as the press and TV and media, unless it was, of course, this is the thing that keeps the truth out of the press, as Swinton tells us.
Yes.
But
yes.
I think that this is, and they were saying some years ago, they're drinking in the Last Chance Saloon, and I believe that far too much has gone out from stuff on your website and the talks and Boleyn and all the people that put out really good stuff. Sensible adult older people now are actually coming around. They're actually using the wisdom, and they're actually believing what they're seeing rather than just accepting what they're told to see.
Yep.
But I think that this is the turning of the whole thing. Norway, I think, will prove to have been the tip of the iceberg, and they're going to go down as a result of this.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, David, everybody wants to polarize this fight, and you know I'm not religious, you know that, and I've made that clear to my listeners that I don't take a stand on any particular religion or all of that. What I am is a guy who is incensed by what he discovered, and I grew up with at least a moral compass that, you know, what I called this, David, recently was what's happened under the Zionist control over our globe. We have had the death of shame.
Yes.
And as shame has died, so too have we slipped into the abyss. And so as I see it, I was born with a healthy dose of shame, because you're supposed to have that,
yes,
and a healthy dose of empathy and sympathy for my fellows. And when you have that as a combination within your personality, you can't help but take a stand on these issues, because you are duty bound to yourself to say,
yes,
this is enough now.
To thine own self be true.
That's right. And so I welcome people who are religious, not religious, Islam, Christian, Jews. I don't care if they're interested in a moral compass that is going to lead them to a solution here. Then they can join us, you know.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. There are good and bad in all groups, but there's a particular spirit that runs through the Zionists or the groups who are not Torah conscious. You know, they reject the Ten Commandments and all the things that that says, and that is the problem. It is a demonic spirit. It's the problem that we're faced with, and that's what comes through in the oaths in Freemasonry. And this, the whole thing, aim of Freemasonry, as we touched on before, is to serve them and their agenda in usurping the rights of the real residents of Palestine, who, regardless of whether they're Muslim, Jews, or Christians, if so long as they uphold the covenant that was made between Abraham and that Jesus came to fulfill, then they believe in those principles, and so that everybody has a right to live there if they, providing they uphold those principles. But
well, David, let's talk for a minute about this group, this Ashkenazi group, this the Kagan structure and their phallic worshiping. But through, we already know Sabbatai Zevi took a big shift in their thinking, and they saw him as a means to an end to get to where they wanted to be in a dominant position. But let's go further, closer to history, when Jacob Frank got involved and even deepened the sickness within this group. And this is, I think, he's the guy, I think, who spawned this movement. I mean, not the spawning of it. The birth of it came from Sabbatai Zevi, but the real growth in this movement out of the East, in Poland and in Ukraine and areas of this area, came from the Frankist movement. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah. Well, the strands are they intertwine, but it's far older than that. This is why the Satanic Voice is ancient and modern. It was to go to the origins of this, and if you hear Marx or you hear Pharaoh, you know, there may be the voice, but the actual voice is the ventriloquist of Shaitan, because he is the master of the whole game plan. Because it's I was just looking at Jefferson, he said, look, single acts of tyranny may be ascribed to an accidental opinion of the day, but a series of oppressions become at a distinguished period unalterable through every change of ministers too plainly prove a deliberate, systematic plan of reducing us to slavery. Now, he wasn't a loony left. I mean, Jefferson did understand that when you say about conspiracy theories, yes, there is a conspiracy, and it's the ancient one that has run from the time of Adam till today. Shabbat Zvi and you see the symbolism, the Israeli flag,
yes.
the Morgenstern, that has nothing to do with David, but it has everything to do with David Alroy, the magician, and that is the symbol. It's the tantric magic, the symbol of copulation, and that's what when you ask people, say, well, what does it mean? They have no idea, and so what they parade around is something that, if they understood, but as you rightly said, people have lost their sense of shame. And if I can add some things to why that may have happened, people will laugh, but when you think about it, maybe there's obviously a grain of truth in it, that people lose, alcohol leads to violence, the consumption of pig meat leads to shamelessness. And so societies where you find the consumption of alcohol and khanzir, as they say, or, you know, you find that this is part of the problem, that it is you become what you eat and what you drink.
Well, now, David, I'm going to part company with you here, because I got to say, honestly, I live out in the countryside of France, okay?
Yeah.
And nobody I know, no country I know drinks more wine and eats more pig than the French. But I got to tell you, my neighbors and the people where I live are very moral, and they're very, very quick to help, and they have a good, strong sense of shame, and they're very conservative, and because I live around farmers.
Yes.
And but they're major pork eaters, and they're major wine drinkers. They've got the big red nose and the cheeks that have broken blood vessels.
The pigs,
but they still get up at 4:30 in the morning and they work until dark.
Yes.
And they put in, you know, and they don't ask anybody for anything, and they are self-sufficient humans. And the simple fact of the matter is, I don't have that personal experience in a country that eats the most pork and drinks the most alcohol.
Well,
so I have to part company with you on that specific thing.
I'm just putting it out there.
Well, you know, in fact, the French, the only other thing they do is eat so much cheese that you know, it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, for all, David, these guys should be dying at 50 if the medical profession had any truth to it. They eat pork, they drink alcohol, and they eat cheese, and they live to be 80. I don't understand it, but this is the facts. Anyway,
they'd probably live to 120 if they didn't, though.
That's very possible.
Right.
Well, you know, so here we are now. Let's talk a little bit about the movement into America from Britain. Now, we know they wanted to redraw the map of Europe, and the way they did that was by fomenting. They fomented World War II. They got the Jews of the world to go against Germany in the 30s. They even availed themselves to loans early in the 30s for Hitler's war machine to get underway, including the IB Farben's factories being built and the deals that were made between Ford Motor Company and all this. So we know that they were deeply involved in the financial side of both sides of the war, but they were also waiting for that war to really destroy and create enough mayhem and enough suffering that they could swoop in and redraw the maps and redraw the political maps and do the whole thing. They were quite successful at it, but it was only a stage. And according to Albert Pike, his Third World War scenario is exactly where we are today.
It is, no doubt about that. And so that's why, I mean, it is... and also prophecies from across the Christian and Muslim, spectrum, that we are living in the end times, and the few wars and earthquakes and all these things are happening, and we ignore those things at our peril. But yes, the agenda is one that's been set, and they've been working assiduously towards that end. And the Balfour Declaration, for instance, that was declared in November 1917 because we were losing the war, and we had to bring America in, and which was partly, well, which was mainly to do with the promise of the Jewish national home to the American Jews and the German Jews, and that's precisely why it was done.
And that was Baruch and Morgenthau and all of the New York Jews that had sway over Wilson.
Yes. Yes, definitely. But it was also as part of the one who wrote the Balfour Declaration, of course, was not necessarily Lord Balfour, but it was Julian Emery, wasn't it?
Yep.
And the Emery. So, but you are dealing with masters of deception, and they plan, they work to a plan, and they plan the work. And the rest of the people don't have any idea that this is going on, so they assume that everybody is just like them, that they are normal and they want the same things for each other. And but that's our first mistake. And we have to learn from those and realize that this is Pike's assessment. Of course, I think he was very much involved with
Freemasonry.
Palmerston. Yeah, oh yes, very much, with the Lord Palmerston as well. And this is going according to that plan. But I think I've sent you Ben-Gurion's. I mean, if you ignore Ben-Gurion's 1962 prediction, of course, everything that's happening is even more stark when you read his prophecies or his predictions of the world by 1987. And that the whole agenda of the world wars is to bring about world government in Jerusalem. And everything has happened according to his plan. You know, Gorbachev comes to power by 1987. The wall comes down, and then we have the European Union, which is also predicted, and that America will be transformed into a welfare state with a planned economy. Now, that's America is in that phase, and Rahm Emanuel, who of course is the patron saint of Rahm Emanuel, is David Ben-Gurion.
Yeah,
and
the
plan he's written is all going according to plan, and
but they're failing in some of the areas. Here's the wild card that came and that they didn't expect. the internet came along, and they believed it to be a better tool for manipulation than it was exposing them. So they said, okay, let's, because it was their decision to go ahead with it, because you can see the ownership of the internet, all of the major companies and all of the major infrastructure businesses are Jewish run or controlled.
Yeah.
So we know darn well that they were there from the birth of this. But my point is that it had a potential they did not see.
Yes. Well, this is the point that, if I can be so bold as to say that the prophecies about the end time, now the Antichrist, which are, these are the forces, if you read to see what's happening and you identify the dominance, the poverty, starvation, all the things that you see the four horsemen of the apocalypse carrying out, it's already here. Bush, Scowcroft and Kissinger being three of them. I mean, this is the policy, but the good news is that they will fail, and the prophecy from Muhammad, alayhi salatu salam, he said, when Dajjal, now Dajjal in his, of course the language of Jesus was Aramaic, and Dajjal or Dagala is the those who come in and they're wolves in sheep's clothing. And when the wolves in sheep's clothing fail to bring the world under his control through their machinations and systems of false belief, that the Christian nations would gather under 80 banners to try and bring peace in the world, but eventually will destroy the world and bring about its destruction. So this lot will fail. There will be a period. I know that you're not in from a religious disposition, but for sure the second coming, according to the Islamic prophecies, is imminent in the Quran, and that preceding that will be Al-Mahdi, and this will be the alliance. This will overturn the whole system almost within 12 months. The whole game plan that's currently afoot will actually be overturned, and that is what all the prophecies say, the secular ones as well as the religious ones.
Well, I can tell you from a financial, my financial expertise I can bring to bear on this. The truth of the matter is that we've reached the end of the European experiment, because they just did not, in its inception, they did not take into account that these economies had such disparate qualities and qualifications that they could not be glued together. It's kind of like if you're welding steel pipe to a copper pipe. They're different.
Yeah, well, dissimilar metals are very hard to weld, and particularly aluminium and steel you can, but I know a bit about welding, and you're right. It's very, very difficult.
That's right, because as soon as any pressure is put on those lines, the cracks form, and then the thing starts leaking, and there it goes. It's gone.
Yes,
well,
yes.
This is exactly the case for Europe, and it was this two-tiered system that should have been implemented that wasn't. So,
well, yes, it was right. It was supposed to be a two-tier system, but everybody's in tears, as they say.
Well, that's right. Well, because they rushed this into their plan. Now, the Americans on the
Sorry about that. I just want to. I don't know if I sent you the Maastricht report by Professor Michie about the implications for signing the Maastricht Treaty, done in 1993 for NALGO, that was the National and Local Government Officers Association in England, in the UK. Now, Michie wrote this in 1993. I'll send it to you. It's worth posting. But he predicted everything that's happening, and as of last week, the figure would be in excess of 20 million across Europe unemployed. We reached 24.3 million last week. And so everything about it, when you have a monetary system, they should have, as the man who designed the euro system was Bernard Leiter, who I know very well. And he and I went to Malaysia in 2002. But Leiter said that he was the head of the Central Bank of Belgium. And he said what we needed was a common currency, but to retain the franc and the Deutsche Mark and everything. Then, like was happening in Greece, they could issue the drachma when they want local currency. And they shouldn't be borrowing money as a government. It's madness.
That's right.
Absolutely madness.
Well, David, you know, we're looking at Europe going down, but here's the thing. The Federal Reserve has been lending...
Feudal reserve, we call it.
Huh? Well, yeah, because we're heading into this plutocratic... I don't know, it's fascism, because they're marrying themselves to these businesses, but it's also neo-feudalism.
Yes.
So, I mean, all of these right. things apply, and here's the thing, you know, with the Fed being the world's banker, which it is, and it works hand in glove with the Bank of International Settlements out of Switzerland,
what we
found is that the American economy, as huge as it is, 25% of the world's GDP,
yes.
was bled out in order to keep the rest of the world afloat until whatever plans they have for us right. were brought to fruition.
Well, just stop at that point. Remember what the protocols say. We will use the arms of China and Japan. China is now the weapon. You notice I was involved in seeing all the manufacturing moving from the States, you know, manufacturing good.
Yep.
That's been the game plan, and behind it is Rothschild, and Rothschild, and the
yes.
and the usual suspects.
Oh, David, have you read the book called The Jews of China?
I have, yes, I have a copy.
Oh, my goodness, and how Mao Zedong's, all of his right-hand and left-hand men, the people who did the planned economy for him in the background were from the Jewish community.
Yes, of course, you know, the retail for Gentiles, always remember that, though. That you have to be, the power is in the money. Once you lose control of that, as Rothschild said, "Now permit me to issue a nation's currency, it's irrelevant who writes its laws." But the Jews of China, the money is the key, and the protocols give you every step by step.
Yep.
And when they come to power, in their state, of course, Protocol 21, they'll never allow borrowing to go on. Why would you? And there's the marvelous interview in the Israeli's book, you know, when he's talking to Sidonia, and he said he has to go to see the minister who's now running out of money, not an unusual event in the United Kingdom. And he said how foolish it is that a government would come to a private individual. And have you read the Sidonia?
No.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's actually the most accurate description of the problems. And it's written by Disraeli, who, of course, was certainly not an Irishman.
No.
And he did understand the problem, but it's wonderful. You must get, I'll copy it to you. But it's essential reading, because he said about revolution, who's behind it, it's their firm.
Well, he was the Rasputin of Britain, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, but I think he was far better. I mean, Rasputin, no, he was far better than Rasputin. He was an honest man, and I think what he said could never have been said by anybody who wanted them to succeed. But read Sidonia, and it's fantastic.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the one that we don't talk about, but it's very dear and near to the British history, and that is India. Back in 1993, Rothschild gave a private speech that was printed, and he talked about that being the country that he was anointing as the future growth country in the world.
Right. Yep.
Now, everyone at the time, when I told him this some 8 years ago, laughed and said, "No, it's China." And I said, "No, it isn't." I said, "You think it's China, but you watch China go down the tubes." And I said, "This guy has picked India." And I watched as their Chabad Lubavitch houses spread all over that country. I watched as the defense relationships between Israel and India have expanded year after year after
year.
Well,
they have a history of worshipping cows, both of them, don't they? That's the thing.
Well, you know, they only had their foothold in that Catholic city of Goa when they started, and they moved from Goa out like a plague.
Yeah, but remember, look, my great-great-grandfather was, he was East India Company, and from 1840, the Campbell Regiment, my mother's maiden name is Campbell Thomas, so I'm very familiar, and I've spent three solid years in India, and I've observed exactly what you're saying, but certainly India is, it has more, China, of course I'm familiar with China, but you're right. India and China, I mean, if they combine together, and there's strong links between them, but they have the undoing of India and the impeachment of Warren Hastings and was the fact that the Nawabs and everything, once the Bengal Lancers got there, and my mother's side on the Irish side, they opened the first Masonic lodges in Bengal, and when you draw the Nawabs and the princes into that, you see how whether the Zionists, the Jews, were there in person, but their system of Freemasonry is the thing that precedes them. And that's why when you say we're going to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, all your interest is in actually helping those who share the same objective. And so while you didn't see them, I've been all over India from top to bottom. But having the history from my mother's side, and my uncles and my father being there installing the first rolling mills in India, in Howrah, we've got a good history, but it has the potential. But the problem is they can't organize themselves, and as Galbraith said it when he was ambassador, India is a fully functioning anarchy, and it is. The problem is that everybody believes it's not my job, it's the pecking order, so things get left for months. I've seen things left there that you would think, well, why is that not being done? And if you go and do it yourself, it's mortification. You're the president of the company. How can you go and move that rock? It's true. So China is far more disciplined. India is far more difficult. But, of course, it has the numbers. And what they're looking for is the growth in the middle class and the consumption of exported goods.
Well, they also have a very stratified society that they can exploit.
Yes.
And it's that stratification that gives them power over one group over another.
Yes. And that was precise. But that, remember that the British have been the masters of this, and the separation of Pakistan and India, we left two warring factions, which of course was the objective. And so the masters of the deception are still the British. And I think that it was what was his name, the guy who wrote Clash of Civilizations. He was pointing out that it was the Anglo-Saxons' ability to wage to apply violence that actually succeeded in them holding and winning these places, but also, as I said, it's down to propaganda and the subtlety of propaganda, which the Brits have been the best at.
Well, the last thing I want to broach here is a theory that I have, David, and it's regarding the underlying reasons for both Iraq, Libya, and of course the possibility of even Iran. And Afghanistan, for that matter. But let me give you a quick synopsis. You give me your take on it. The British used this strategy in South Africa when they wanted to exploit the ownership and control over the gold mines. They had to get rid of the white Dutch Afrikaners who were sitting on the land.
Mm.
So they sent down their troops, and this was, of course, the Brown Table sent them down with Cecil Rhodes, and it was at the behest of Rothschild, of course, and Oppenheimer. They sent down an expeditionary force of Brits down there, and these guys were murdered and raped, pillaged, and plundered in a horrible way, creating some of the world's first modern concentration camps, starved these white farmers to death. When the land was cleared, there was no food available for the blacks. So what the blacks had to do in order to just eat was to listen to their masters now, and the masters were these new controllers who said, we'll feed you if you go into our mines.
Yeah.
And they set up Soweto as a ghetto, and they employed them in the mines, and they raped, pillaged, and plundered the natural resources of South Africa. Now, Iraq. We come to Iraq. They say we're going in to bring democracy. Instead, they forced 6 million of them to emigrate. The people who stayed, they killed another 2 or 3 million of them in outright murder. And then the rest of the society is on the verge of dying from being poisoned by depleted uranium. So what they've succeeded in doing in the cradle of civilization is depopulating that entire area, leaving behind access to these natural resources that not now, if they're thinking long-term, which you don't believe a long-term is even possible, but thinking long-term, their idea is that in 50 years, when there is no more oil left, whatever oil there is left is going to be worth its weight in gold because it has so many ancillary uses. So, but they don't want to share that with a population. So the best way to have what they want is to kill everybody off, just like they did in South Africa, and displace and dispossess the people. And so now we'll move over to Libya, where they've only got 6.5 million people, a huge well of oil, and some of the greatest water supplies in the world, and only 6.5 million to murder. And so they're going to displace and destroy these people. Now, it seems to me that the agenda has always been get rid of the natives, get rid of their control, covet the natural resources, and do it with the American young men and British young men to die for it. And they're doing it again here with this NATO attack in Libya. And they're actually, whether he knows it or not, in the long run, if this thing goes on for a while, Gaddafi will be helping them because his resistance is they're killing each other off. In other words, the civil war that's developing, or they'd like to develop, is going to depopulate that place.
Right. Well, let me come to the point to try and pull all that together. First of all, the policy of depopulation. You must have read Kissinger's
absolutely, I have
NSSM 200.
Yes,
the National Security Memorandum. Now, I have the report done by James Akin. Now, Akin was America's ambassador to Saudi Arabia in 1973-75. And Akin's, when he was told about the plan, Kissinger's plan to wage a war for oil, his report, I'm sure I must have sent it to you, but if not, his reply was, when he was called War for Oil with Armageddon as Fun City. And Akins was the eminent specialist in hydrocarbons. He was ambassador to Saudi Arabia. His report, which I've just mentioned the title of, was War for Oil. Now, the plan was then that they would depopulate Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates, repopulated with American, Texas and Oklahoma oil men. And that was the plan. Now, when Akins heard of this and he was interviewed in London, he said, and I've got all the correspondence with him, because I wanted, like you do, I went and did the due diligence to talk to see if I could find out.
Yep.
And it took me 5 years. I spoke to Akins. I was told he was dead, but I rang the number in Washington, and his wife answered the phone. He came on the phone, and he told me that the report, he hadn't been able to get a copy of it, even though he'd written it, but they said, under freedom of information, you can get it. It took me 5 years. I got it, and I've republished it myself. But in that is the policy, and he warns America, if you do this, you will have insurrection, you will have the oil fields will be set on. Everything that happened in Iraq happened according to this warning that Akins gave. Now, Akins, he's dead now. He died last year, I believe. But his report is stunning because it spells out what the game plan is. Now, the idea that Iraq was, again, of course, the pretext was that when I did that program on Central Television with Miles Copeland, Christopher Monckton, who was then the leader writer for the Evening Standard, Hazir Tomurian, and General Sir John Hackett. And when I walked into the warm-up room in the Central Television, Miles Copeland, I was introduced as David Pidcock, leader of the Islamic Party of Britain. Oh, he said, "Hi, Dave, what are you going to say?" So I said, the pretext for America entering World War I was the sinking of the Lusitania. Her pretext for entering World War II was the sinking of the fleet at Pearl Harbor. And the pretext for her controlling the oil fields of Hejaz is the sinking of the U.S. Kuwait. They said, "Christ, we're going to have problems with you." but you're absolutely right.
That's right.
Monckton, who was sitting to my right, choked on his gin and tonic and spat it over General Sir John Hackett. And now, after, of course, they wouldn't let me say that because they avoided, I couldn't even get a word in on the program.
Mm.
But after that, Miles Copeland came up to me and I got a copy of his book, The Game Plan. Page 68 69, and he talks about when they said of the CIA that it was actually Admiral Sidney Sowers went to inform Roosevelt and Truman, and he said that he informed Truman that with the setting up of the CIA, which Copeland was a founder member, he said there will never be another Pearl Harbor. And Truman responded, and it's on page 68 and 69 of the gameplay, he said, "Obviously you have not read your secret briefing yet, otherwise you would know President Roosevelt got the intelligence but allowed the attack to go ahead as a way of arousing an otherwise apathetic populace." And he signed the book, which Muhammad Ali borrowed, and he didn't give me back. But anyway, I got a photograph of the signature, but we talked a couple of times. He said, "When Muslims start to think, we've got problems."
Yeah, well, here's the reason. Libya's only got a small population. But what's working against the NATO forces is that the tribes are very, very independent and within their own country boundaries. And so, whether or not they're going to win or lose there, you know, your predictions from a religious standpoint say they will lose. What I'm saying is that this is just business as usual, and you can take this form of theft back all the way to the Boras, but now it's the Americans doing it with Iraq, and they're doing it with Libya. They want to do it with Iran. I think they're even willing, David, this is how crazy these people are, willing to use neutron-type weaponry against the Iranians and wipe out their population.
Sure.
And of course, the people left behind after a horrendous nuclear attack are just walking around. They're the walking dead.
Yes, they are.
And,
But the point is, did you notice the most telling thing? I've been very much involved in training the steelman who came to Sheffield from Misrata. So I know a lot about that. And a friend of mine's father was the head of the Central Bank of Libya. Now, the first thing that they wanted there, and the game plan is, Libya did not have a central bank and it had no external debt. That is the key. Why would have you ever heard of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid coming back and saying we want to open a central bank? But that is the game. You've got to be able to leverage all that future oil wealth, but they had no debt, and apparently the loss to the banking industry of the debt that governments would usually have was so massive that Libya was in the frame. But Christopher Bolling's article here, and I was told this 20 years ago, that of course Gaddafi's mother was Jewish, and this is now coming out, and he can actually claim right of return to go to Israel if he wishes. So how about that for a curveball?
Well, again, how would they leverage him if he were working with them? I can't say that he is or not because I don't have any definite proof. But what I can say is him remaining there as an opposition to the rebels, basically the civilians are going to get depopulated. They're going to either move out.
Well, they're not bothered out. The idea is to get rid of the useless eaters, and that's Kissinger and Bush clearly. So if you get rid of them by starvation, by economic means where possible, by military means where necessary, that is that we are the masters, you shine our shoes. So this is game plan. But unfortunately with Gaddafi, he's always been a lunatic, and he should have been arrested for bad taste in dressing. He was the style council that organized the war.
Well, David, he always was playing politics because he did backdoor deals with Israel over the years.
Yeah.
He also took the blame in the national international world on Lockerbie, which he didn't do.
Yeah. But this is the game that we've got traitors within the camp, like Gamal Abdel Nasser. He was Jewish. He was also Miles Copeland's ace pupil, and he ran Gamal Abdel Nasser, and the whole game plan in Egypt was to get rid of the British, but they were going to stay there. So things have got to be laid out. And the Pan Am 103 thing, of course, that was all part of the game fracture to justify, the attack on Libya. But it was an American job, just like 9/11. An Israeli job.
Israeli and Americans, that's right. Yeah. Well, David, we've reached well over an hour. I want to thank you.
Right.
This was wonderful to have you back on because...
Thank you.
We don't get to talk as much as we did, but I hope that changes soon.
Good.
And we did a great show here. Ladies and gentlemen, David Pidcock, a good friend, always an interesting conversation with David, and I want to thank him once again. David, I will
thank
be talking talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. God bless, and look forward to speaking to you. And I'll send you those things on Maastricht, and particularly on James Akin. The ambassador, who was a fantastic character. So I'll send you some stuff and you can post it.
Well, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, until the next time, this is Daryl Bradford Smith telling you all, please take care of your families and be well. Bye-bye.